Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We arrive at this Friday at the end of a week of grief and of anger. We will remember this as the week that George Floyd was killed in what looks like cold blood on the video, and we will remember this as the week when the 100,000th American died of COVID-19. That 100,000th death comes in the context of the United States having 4% of the world's population, 28% of the officially recorded coronavirus deaths. The killing of George Floyd, in what looks like cold blood on video, comes in the context of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, not accused of anything, killed by apparent vigilantes, caught on a video, in the context of a white woman in Central Park, caught on video calling the police to claim a black man was threatening her and her dog when all he was apparently doing was telling her to stop breaking the law and put her dog on a leash. It comes in the context of activists trying to get more attention for the police killing of emergency medical technician Breonna Taylor in Louisville, a COVID first responder, not suspected of anything, after they apparently burst into her apartment with a no-knock warrant looking for someone else. The week of Memorial Day 2020 will be memorialized for grief and for anger. Later this hour, we will talk to State Senator Brian Benjamin of Harlem, who has a new bill in response to the Central Park incident, adding false reporting to the police based on race as a hate crime in New York State. It would add it to the rolls of the hate crimes. We'll get Senator Benjamin's take on the larger context of that as well. And after Senator Benjamin, we'll talk to Mayor de Blasio about all these things. We'll talk first about President Trump's relationship to this week of anger and grief with New York Times columnist David Brooks. There is new news this morning that Twitter placed a warning on a new tweet by the president for what Twitter calls glorifying violence. It was glorifying police violence, military violence, in fact, as he tweeted about the unrest in Minneapolis, saying the police, the military, would get involved if necessary. Quote, any difficulty and we will assume control. When the looting starts, the shooting starts. David Brooks' latest column about the president's response to grief is called If We Had a Real Leader. But before we bring David on, he retweeted a different video this morning that he found worthy of wider distribution. And so, as a prelude, I want to play you about a minute and a half of that video. It's not new, but I guess it's newly relevant, always relevant, but newly relevant to the headlines. A monologue by a man named Tyler Merritt. Maybe you know some of his work. Just talking about himself. It's been retweeted 40,000 times.
I am a Christian. I spend almost every Sunday morning teaching kids in Sunday school. I am often asked if I am Muslim. I'm okay with that. I'm pretty much convinced if you met my mother, you'd automatically become a better person. My father is a veteran. He taught me how to say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, to everyone that I meet. I don't hate our president. I pray for him. I love basketball and also hockey. This is my brother, James. This is my brother, Mike. This is my brother, John. And this is my brother, Rob. I've never been to jail. I've never owned a gun. I hate that anyone at all might possibly be afraid of me. I'd go around the world and back again if I knew that single act might make your day better. I'm a proud man. I'm a proud black man. Does any of this really matter? No. I just wanted you to get to know me better before you called the cops.
From the Tyler Merritt Project, that's been retweeted 40,000 times, one of them by New York Times columnist David Brooks, who joins me now. David's book about people's journeys after being confronted with themselves, called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, is also just out in paperback. David, thanks for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you again, Brian.
Why did you retweet the Tyler Merritt video?
Because I think it's not the only solution to some of our racial problems, but a solution. One of the problems of the essence of racism is not seeing a full human being. It's essentializing. It's seeing a category and assuming because you know one thing, the color of a person's skin, you know them. And I think what the video does is it's just a black guy talking directly into the camera, but giving you all sorts of information about a full human being, some of which is supposed to defy stereotypes. I like basketball. I also like hockey. Earlier in the video, he says, I can recite every word from NWA Straight Outta Compton, but I also like the musical Oklahoma. And so you see a human being in all their richness. And to me, our inability to see the fullness of each other is one of the moral cores or moral corruptions that underlays a lot of the racism in society.
Suddenly, Twitter this week has taken to fact-checking a few tweets and now placing this warning label this morning on the one about Minneapolis by President Trump. What do you make of that?
I think I support it. I don't think they should be banned. I don't think it helps to ban what the president is saying. I think people should see what he's saying and have a chance to make a decision about that in the fall. I don't mind the warnings. I do think community standards are important and norms are important and calling out bad behavior is important. One of the things I've sort of been watching this whole pandemic through the prism of social trust, can we establish norms and behaviors to look after one another? And on the mass level, I've been pretty impressed about how we've mostly worn masks, how we've mostly enforced norms. If you go to my local grocery store and you're not wearing a mask, somebody's going to say something to you. And I sort of am impressed by how the body politic has responded. Not so impressed by people on the top of our society. And so I think what Twitter is doing is say, you know, we're going to let you have your say. You're the president. But it's not just anything goes anymore. We have certain standards, and we're at least going to say something if those standards are violated. And I think that's the basis of a healthy community.
Your column called If We Had a Real Leader was written in the context of COVID-19. It was before the president's tweet about the military shooting Americans in the streets. But in the context of what if we had a real leader, what did you think when you saw that tweet?
Horror. I mean, there really is no bottom. I mean, it's an almost daily barrage. I mean, we're just a few days away from him vaguely accusing Joe Scarborough of murder and this crazy conspiracy. And so I think we've been at this for 3 or 4 years, and the inability to say, I understand the rage, I understand what the video shows, and maybe I still don't like rioting, and that would be at least a complicated response. But the president just loves to put on the show of manliness and also to, well, frankly, divide the country, and I think he sees it as a strategy. But I think it's deeper than that. He fundamentally has no sympathy for people in certain parts of our population.
And your column, If We Had a Real Leader, references some clips of past presidents that Mary Louise Kelly played for you on All Things Considered. One of them, I'm going to replay it, was this of President Obama after the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting of first graders.
They had their entire lives ahead of them. Birthdays, graduations, weddings, kids of their own.
And you got one line of comment after that clip in that segment that had you and a second guest the first time around on ATC. Would you like to stretch out and elaborate a little more here?
Well, I think, you know what, one of the things Obama did in that speech was he just read out the first names of the kids who were killed. And he upheld the dignity of each individual. It wasn't just a mass of deaths. It was unique individuals. He also spoke out of his own pain. I think when you have a real leader, whether it's Reagan after Challenger, Bush after 9/11, even Lincoln after Gettysburg, they come to you outside their political role and in a posture of humility. And I think we all who have been around grieving and who have grieved ourselves, we all know the thing we want most is not cure, but presence. We just want somebody to show up for us. And I think Obama, both there and in Charleston after the church shooting, the first thing he did was he just showed up. And he was just in pain, experiencing pain, accompanying pain. And I think that's, you know, what a president does. Our current president is unable to be vulnerable, unable to step out of politics, unable to step out of himself. And so, you know, and the other thing they do is a normal president is they draw on our common sources. You know, Obama and Charleston sang Amazing Grace. I mentioned in the column that Robert Kennedy, right after the death of Martin Luther King, quoted Aeschylus, Lincoln constantly going back to the Bible or the Declaration. There are certain common sources that our culture grows out of, and they go back to those. And they're sources of strength that unite us. Every president until the current one sort of knew how to do this because they had some fundamental decency. You forget how just morally and psychologically draining it is to not have a leader who behaves normally with some basic sense of humanity.
And by contrast, in that All Things Considered segment, they played a clip of President Trump as the 100th death from coronavirus was recorded, in contrast to President Obama, and the clip of Trump was this.
Will some people be affected? Yes. Will some people be affected badly? Yes. But we have to get our country open, and we have to get it open soon.
And you wrote in your column that if we had a real leader, she would speak of the dead as not just a faceless mass, but as individual persons. And it makes me think of one of the themes of the protesters right now, which is to say the names, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor. What would you say about the importance of humanizing the dead by saying their names and otherwise treating them as individuals in the context of injustice and even in the context of COVID, where there are so many?
Yeah, I was proud of my newspaper a few days ago, putting the names of many thousands on the front page. And I do think there's a great philosophy. Jacques Maritain was among the founders in the 20th century called personalism. And it's the idea that the core of ethical behavior is seeing the full person in all their infinite dignity. Each person is an infinite soul, and the extinguishing of a person is an extinguishing of an infinite soul, or maybe the passing on of a soul, depending on your religious beliefs. But once you begin abstracting and seeing masses or just seeing categories, you're really doing damage to society. And that can be in the most brutal ways, just seeing someone, say, as a black man, even in trivial ways. And this may seem trivial, but it's been a personal thing in my life. I wrote a book about 20 years ago called Bobos in Paradise about the social category Bobos. And as I've gotten older and as I've seen society, and that was sort of a comic book, I was telling a lot of jokes, I've become more uncomfortable with reducing people to types. And I think, you know, it starts out small with the jokes about a type, yuppies or whatever, but it turns big before too long as we reduce each other to types. And one of the things I loved about that Merrick video was that it smashed all the types. It was just a human being. And so personalism is a philosophy that just insists on that uniqueness of each human being.
And listeners, we can take phone calls today. First, mostly on what presidential leadership would look like in this week of grief and anger. over the 100,000th death from COVID-19 in this country and the death of George Floyd in the context of all of American history, really. We'll get into other aspects of the grief and anger with other guests as we go. 646-435-7280 is our phone number, 646-435-7280, for New York Times columnist David Brooks. And Rosemary in the West Village called in. I think she knows Tyler Merritt. Rosemary, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your show on this. It's extremely important. And I do know Tyler. Yes, I actually met Tyler when I was in my teenage years. We were part of a mission group, a Christian mission group at that time, both evangelicals and Pentecostal church that went overseas to deliver the good news. And then we went to Bible college together, and I left that milieu and went a very different direction after college and grad school. And as an aside, David Brooks, as an academic, I'm very familiar with the philosophy of personalism, and I'll get back to that. But I will say that that year, that video with Tyler is over a year old, and it took so much courage for him to make that, given that in our milieu, which he stayed in, he was always the token Black guy. He was the person that everybody, as long as he behaved and he comported himself extraordinarily well and was very careful, that people could point to and say, I'm not racist, I'm friends with Tyler. And for him to go through his journey to get to the point of making that video and disseminating it and putting his face out there to say, these rampant killings of Black people are wrong, of Black men are wrong, this needs social accountability, was extraordinary. So I just want to first mention that this was not something that his Christian evangelical environment actually really facilitated. It's something he had to break away from in many ways to do. And to your point, David, about humanizing people, I think it's wonderful to humanize. I think we absolutely have to have that. I think Tyler was responding to that, absolutely. But we can't have that without systemic oversight, community oversight of the police. I mean, that's being shown in our own neighborhood. It's not only in Minneapolis that these god-awful things are happening. It was in the East Village where social distancing was deemed to be not occurring and the police sat on a Black man's head. Meanwhile, in the neighborhood on Christopher Street Pier, they're crowding white people closer together to get them off the newly seeded lawn and handing out face masks. I mean, come on. I'm going to disclose here that I'm a board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which brought, along with Communities United for Police Reform, the first cases, the many cases against the stop and frisk policing, and is now using those precedents to go after this social distancing enforcing that is targeting Black and brown people. This is not anything that our social norms, that good social relationships, that a philosophy of personalism recognizing the whole person is going to fix by itself.
David.
Well, I agree with that. I think I said you start with personalism, but obviously we're a nation of laws and we're a nation of procedures. I haven't really thought about this. I do think there should be some enforcement of the norms of social distancing, whether that's a law enforcement thing or just a social thing. Society is very powerful when people fear they're going to be shamed if they don't wear a mask. When everyone wants them to wear a mask, they're going to wear a mask. Should we have government enforcement of that? Well, the evidence suggests that when you do have government enforcement, you get more adherence to the rules. On the other hand, you may get unequal enforcement, so minorities are targeted and suffer most. That's a complicated thicket, but on the whole, I'm glad.
It speaks to the need to have government enforcement with community oversight of government. We obviously, this is very patently clear in every single direction in this current crisis and the ways that it is bringing other crises together and exacerbating longstanding state failures. We cannot have government oversight. We can't have great leaders without community oversight, robust community oversight and checks of those leaders, be they police officers, be they the president, be they public health officials, whatever. Those mechanisms need to be more robust. We need to be enfranchising and building power in more communities rather than disenfranchising them, which is what this crisis is contributing to, already existing inequalities.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that. Obviously, civil society is supposed to oversee government, and that's why this is a democracy. So I would just underline everything you just said.
Rosemary, thank you for your call. And some of this goes to the themes, or one of the themes of your book, on the centrality of community in the quest for a moral life. I wonder how you see that in the context of defining community broadly across the lines of one's own race or privilege for example, and in the context of what Rosemary said.
Yeah, well, the book is really an attack on the hyper-individualism of the last 60 years, a life that tries to be self-sufficient, that emphasizes freedom to the extent of belonging. And it takes social courage, and it takes sort of radical attempts to throw yourself upon other people who are completely unlike yourselves. And I think that's a personal journey for all of us. I mean, I started an organization called Weave, the Social Fabric Project, about 3 years ago. And until the pandemic, I just spent the 3 years basically on the road, often three states a week. And you see the gaps in society. You spend time, just before the shutdown, I spent time in Watts and Compton. And you see the injustices face to face. You see places where rioting, you know, swept through. On the other hand, when you see community builders in Idaho and Nebraska, and then you see them in New Orleans, you find them speaking the same language, a language of moral commitment to community, a language of vocational certitude. I know why I was put on this earth. You see groups of people in every community who sort of run into the hurricane. And when something's wrong, they react and they assume responsibility. And I've seen that in the pandemic. In Baltimore, some friends have created a food distribution network that now serves 1,500 families. And just spoke to a kid in San Jose, California, who's created a place where teachers and parents can cooperate better on their kids' education in a time of pandemic. I've sort of been, at least on the level of civil society, I really didn't know if this would break us or help us heal. And this has been a bad week. This has been a week of breaking. But overall, I've seen a lot of healing. I've seen a lot of people who've taken this pandemic as a shock to the system, as a chance to reset and have a different sort of society. And I have to say, overall, I'm been more impressed and more optimistic about the future of America than I thought I would be in March.
But I don't know. I mean, we're both white. Our next guest after you will be a black New York State elected official, Brian Benjamin. But I think it's important for white people to speak up about things like this too, as you're doing, as I hope I'm doing. One of the things that I'm thinking, though, is how I've had the privilege of thinking that after the civil rights movement or after Katrina or the inequality of the foreclosure crisis or after the election of President Obama, that we'd be in what E.J. Dionne, in the segment you were in and All Things Considered, called a new birth of empathy and justice and solidarity. But so far, and obviously it's not 1954, but the inequalities and injustice gaps have not nearly been closed as much as a lot of well-meaning white people might have too casually predicted would happen after past cataclysms. We'll see what Brian Benjamin thinks as our next guest. But is there any reason for you to think that this time will be different?
Well, you know, these 3 years I spent on the road, and I've spent my whole life on the road, but especially in these 3 years, really came to the realization that we can talk about healing community in America all we want, but unless we really heal racial divides, then it doesn't work, because the racial divide is the core sin of the country, and that has to be addressed first and foremost. And, you know, the 3 years changed my mind about reparations. I used to be against reparations. I think about a year or two ago, I wrote a column in support saying we need something dramatic. We need a show of respect for the suffering that's happened in this country. And that has to come not only in verbally, but in the form of reparations, just to show dignity and respect. And so, I think as you spend more time in different communities around the country, you do get radicalized on this subject. Will we turn around? I remain, I don't know why, maybe it's just temperamental. I do think the country is shifting. I think our politics is about to shift a lot. I think welcomeness toward the state, a sense of interdependence with each other. The pandemic has exposed all sorts of ruptures. I just have some basic faith in the American people's ability to recognize wrong and to be shocked by wrong. and to do something about it. And, you know, you look at the polling, and there's a greater awareness of inequality now. There's a greater awareness of injustice. Twice as many people say they feel more united than divided by this thing. So I do think there's evidence of a willingness to be one country. Even in this hard week, I sort of hold out faith in that. It would be hard for me to go on at my job if I didn't have faith that the people we are all talking with responded well to sin. So I'm sticking with that.
Some pushback, maybe, from Jennifer in Brooklyn. Jennifer, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for having me. David, I read a lot of your columns, and I have to say, like, you know, I'm thinking of a column you wrote, I think it was last week, it was called, like, First Invasion of America, and it, you know, it said things like, to be born American was to be born to a glorious destiny, to be born American was to be born boldly individual, daring, and self-sufficient, to be born American was to bow down to no one, to say I'm no better than anybody else. And it was, you know, a lot of your columns is this nostalgia for an America that never existed for anybody but white men. And, you know, everything you're saying on this call about your travel, they don't show up in your columns. There's a nostalgia. There's a, you know, I think about the 50s or the 60s, the 70s that you talk about, this glory. And I'm like, who was living this life? You know, black people certainly were not. And this video that you played, and this is pushback to you as well, Brian, it's mm-hmm. like, and I think the caller before identified it, the issue is that this black man sounds, he's not a real person. You know, you can get to not be so perfect. You don't deserve to be killed, summarily executed on the street for forging a check for $20. I don't care what kind of person you are. You know, even the situation in Central Park, people are saying, well, he offered her dog a treat. He should not have done that. I mean, it's like, you know, you should have, the man was kept in his living room. Maybe he didn't leave his door open, or you should have done this and done that. You know, at the end of the day, this country was founded on the premise that black people are not full citizens. And when I read your work, David, I don't see that. I don't see it. I see nostalgia. I see a glory of an America that never existed for anyone that doesn't look like the two of you.
David?
Well, that column, the passage you read, was taken from a series of books written in the 1950s. One of them was The American Mind by Henry Steele Commager. And my point in the column was that whole view of America was based on a false premise of existential security, of safety, and that it was only the story of a small minority. And I say one of the things the pandemic has done is it exposed that we don't have that existential safety. So those views were, I was summarizing a certain view of America. And I think I made that pretty clear in the column. That is not the view of America that we can have now.
May I respond?
Please.
There was a sentence in there saying, you know, this doesn't include everybody. You know, it doesn't include the horrors of slavery and genocide, right? There was that sentence. But what I'm saying is that view of America, like a lot of times, the American in your columns, to me, are not imbued with nuance of what it actually means to be, like, you know, if George Floyd is an American and you visited Watts, you visited New Orleans, and you've seen these gaps and you've seen the ways in which those Americans are experiencing the country, that doesn't come across in the columns, is what I'm saying. Like, those experiences are not clear in the columns. Like, I know you have your heart in the right place, and I like reading your work, but oftentimes, it just seems like you're living in a world that's like not at all what the vast majority of people experience on a daily basis. And I want to see that complexity of your travels and your experiences in the work. And I don't see it often. It's like the nostalgia for this America that like most people don't even know when that was, right? It certainly didn't exist. It has never existed in the history of the Republic.
David, one more response.
Yeah, I mean, well, I do my best, you know, but, you know, I wrote about Watts and Compton a couple months ago. I wrote about New Orleans. I spent time on the South Side of Chicago. I wrote about that piece of America. I also spent two columns on rural Nebraska. You know, columns are 850 words. There's a limitation to the form. I hear you. It's something I aim to do. And, you know, now in the pandemic, I'm stuck mobile. But, you know, one of the things I've come to have faith in journalism is the interview. That's what we do. We interview. And it may not be well reflected in my work, but I have interviewed thousands of people a year for 20 years now, and from all parts of America, and with the difficulties of America. And I'm thinking one column of it from the poorest neighborhood in Detroit I did a couple months ago. I've done my best, and I'm sure I've failed, but I've done my best to reflect the America as I've encountered it in all these interviews.
Jennifer, thank you for your call. Keep calling us. And so to wrap this up, David, before we go on to our next guest, the three stages of your construct of the second mountain is that first mountain is individual success, then comes a period of hollowness over that, and the second mountain is that dedication of oneself to things that matter outside of oneself, and therefore a quest for a moral life, the subtitle of the book, because morality is mostly about how we treat other people. And you write personally about yourself. And I guess my last question is, do you think your own story in this regard suggests how difficult seeing that second mountain is in a national context? Because you were already a columnist who wrote for years about public morality, trying to write thoughtfully, and you get critiqued by people like Jennifer and many others, but trying to write thoughtfully about whether people, about things outside yourself. So can we look at the country through the second mountain lens, and whether there's some kind of journey that's a national journey?
Yeah, I would say, you know, nobody's life is ever made by they had a great vacation in Hawaii. When you ask anybody who, what was the making of you, it was always a hard time. And it could be a hard time personally, it could be a hard time socially. And it's in those moments you learn the depths of yourselves. And you really begin to lose interest in some of the desires of the ego, and you gain interest in the desires of the heart and the soul, the desire for relationship and the desire to serve some good. But that period in the valley is a messy period. But people do come out of it with knowledge. We say it, we suffer our way to wisdom. And that's certainly true personally. I also think it's true nationally. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, my organization gathered about 400, what we call weavers, community builders from around the country, into one place. And we just wanted to get to know each other and meet each other and bring community builders from all around the country together so they could just draw sustenance from each other. And it was an attempt to try to create a community of community builders. And of course, race became the dominant subject of that meeting. And it was messy. And there were some people who were afraid to speak and some people who were very loud and indignant about injustice. And it was all over the place. And frankly, we lost control of that meeting. But I'm so grateful in retrospect for the messiness of that meeting. The messy parts were the most educational parts. And so I think you got to learn to just embrace the messiness of this process with a commitment that through the messiness, you'll still be there for each other, that you still feel a sense of common belonging, that we're still one people. And so I think this has been such a painful week, and a lot of the conversations that we have on this issue and have had over the last years have been messy. But I do think it's out of that friction that, you know, you just get to understand each other a little better. And so I still remain hopeful that The Second Mountain is a hopeful book, that out of hardship, some better future is built.
New York Times columnist David Brooks, his latest column is called If We Had a Real Leader. His book, now out in paperback, is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. David, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.